On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Dr. Julia Asante about her new book, The Last Frontier.
Let's face it, we love this materialism that we're wrapped up into. We love our computers, we love our internet, our Google, our Skype, and no matter how you cut it, we're just at the beginning of this technology change. So whether we wind up merging with the machine, as Kurzweil predicts, it's hard to deny this trajectory of technology.
I think we should really enjoy being in physical life. And I think our technology is, in fact, the chief art of our era. And technology is also what is training us to think outside of the box, to think in terms of interdimensionality, and to think in terms of communicating with consciousness in other dimensions. I think that our use of electronics and digital systems are causing us to become more sensitive to subtler and subtler electrical impulses. So I think technology is not at variance or in conflict with the so-called spiritual, but is working with it as an analogy and as a training ground.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, an interesting interview with Dr. Julia Asante, who has some fascinating and fresh perspectives on consciousness, death, and psychic medium communication with the deceased. So I hope you enjoy this dialogue with Dr. Julia Asante. Today, we welcome Dr. Julia Asante to Skeptico to discuss her new book, The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. Dr. Asante is an Ivy League scholar in ancient Near East studies, and here's where things get really interesting, a longtime practicing psychic medium who, even while pursuing her PhD at Columbia, was talking to the dead. So, Dr. Asante, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, your book has received very high praise from the likes of Dr. Dean Radin, Dr. Larry Dossey, who also wrote the introduction, and other notables. So, first of all, congratulations on this fine book.
Well, I'm really honored to have these people, even Deepak Chopra, whose endorsements are very restricted. You know, he's only allowed to do 7 a year, so I'm very privileged.
Fantastic. Well, let's jump into the book. From your website, juliaasante.com, you write, "Just as trillions are spent fighting aging and death, 10 trillion has already been spent making atomic bombs to inflict death on someone else. This seems right to us, and here's what I love, because we view death as life's greatest failure, and we view life, no matter how devalued, as superior to death." Talk a little bit about that.
You know, we are in a grip in our society of the fear of death. Partly it's the fault of the news and entertainment industry, certainly medical industries, even government. Anything you can really name, any institution, even the way we teach what humanity is, supports the fear of death. And so we have these ideas that that's the one thing we most want to avoid in life, rather than it being a natural cycle, rather it being something that you could embrace like other creatures on this planet, that furthers the growth of the psyche. We will fight that growth. We will fight it to the teeth in the all the expressions of he fought cancer and, you know, long battle against cancer, all this kind of stuff, as an enemy or as a pathology.
And you do a nice job in the book of kind of putting this cultural schizophrenia that we have, you put it in kind of a larger context, both
right,
within the context of other cultures and within the context of our time. Talk a little bit about why we have this sense of schizophrenia about this and why we have it now.
Well, I spent a lot of time describing the schizophrenia in that we don't talk about death at home. We don't talk about death to the dying. It's supposedly too stressful for them.
And we used to. We used to do more of that, right?
Yeah. And but on the other hand, we're obsessed with it. In news and entertainment industry, even advertisements here in America, in which you're always being told you're going to get such and such a disease. The body is a time bomb, or you know the Mayan calendar that the whole world's going to be wiped out in 1212. We're always looking for it, and we're always describing to ourselves an unsafe world, an unsafe universe in which death gets you in the end. Now that has strong Judeo-Christian roots as well, because death in the story of creation is a punishment. It's not part of a natural cycle. And in that context, when you die, you don't reunite with the divine. You're gone. It's over with. And that was the official early Judaic view, was that there was no afterlife. Then apocalypticism came along, and you went to sleep until you were resurrected in the body. And at the end of days, you end up with the greatest triumph of all, and that's conquering death itself. So you get to stay alive in your body on earth in the New Jerusalem. So all of these things express a deep and abiding denial of death.
But it isn't quite that cut and dried, is it? Because, as again you point out in the book, any popular survey will tell you that a wide, wide majority of Americans believe in the afterlife, believe in heaven, and usually they don't have quite that kind of bleak view of it. And you know, that brings up kind of an interesting point, because one of the things I hear from skeptics, atheist types, who, when you really push him and make him say uncle on the survival issue with all the evidence pointing in that direction, they say, hey, what are you really advocating here? Most folks already believe in heaven. What's the big change that you're talking about with this idea of survival of consciousness, or understanding that this life isn't what it's all about? How do you respond to that? Don't most people already have an idea, a deep-seated belief that there is more to this life?
Yes, that is true. I don't like the dichotomy heaven-hell thing. So when you say heaven, you automatically think hell. So I try to avoid that word. But that's absolutely true. On the other hand, we're still afraid of death, and we still fight it. In other words, the belief system, the intuitive belief system of knowing that somehow consciousness survives, which is what you're referring to, and the way our society is run, are in conflict. There's no question about that. Our industries, for instance, the health and beauty, anti-aging industries, are all geared towards stopping that moment or delaying that moment of transition as long as possible. If we really allowed our intuitive beliefs of survival of consciousness to come into our society, a lot of this would change, but we don't. We keep them compartmentalized. We keep one in what I would call the zone of the imagination. We think we believe in it, but we really don't invest anything in it. We won't, for instance, try to communicate with those who are already in that non-local reality of non-physical dimensions. And that is also part of the schizophrenia, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, you know, I have to say, even as I bring it up, I'm somewhat conflicted myself. You know, just the other day I was listening to Ray Kurzweil, who has a new book out, How to Create a Mind. And I was struck by how absolutely convincing he sounds on one level. I mean, let's face it, we love this materialism that we're wrapped up into. We love our computers. We love our internet, our Google, our Skype, which I'm talking with you today, and our YouTube. And also, as he points out, hey, we're living longer, we're living better, there's less violence on a global scale, and no matter how you cut it, you know, we're just at the beginning of this technology change. So whether we wind up, you know, merging with the machine, as Kurzweil predicts, and with these farmed body parts and better robots, you know, it's hard to deny this trajectory of technology. So I know that I survive. But I'm constantly reminded that there's this other element that is very much in this materialism, stuff I've created, technology camp, that kind of pulls me in the other direction. Do you sense that?
I have a lot to say about that. I think we should really enjoy being in physical life. And I think our technology is, in fact, the chief art of our era. And technology is also what is training us to think outside of the box, to think in terms of interdimensionality, and to think in terms of communicating with consciousness in other dimensions. If you think just of the telephone, that was an astounding invention. But when it was presented in Philadelphia by Alexander Graham Bell, he used a soliloquy, Hamlet's soliloquy, talking to the skull of all things, to demonstrate the phone in public. And people were nervous and frightened. They thought he was conjuring ghosts. So that kind of technology alone allows our paradigms to open and include discarnates, invisibles, crossing distances, all that kind of thing. The internet is even doing more with the idea of cyberspace and collapsed space. But fundamentally, I think, since all perception is ultimately electrical, all perception, whether it's psychic perception or physical perception, it ultimately relies on electrical impulses that translate it into something in the brain. I think that our use of electronics and digital systems are causing us to become more sensitive to subtler and subtler electrical impulses. So I think technology is not at variance or in conflict with the so-called spiritual, but is working with it as an analogy and as a training ground.
You know, now that's quite controversial, isn't it? Because there's a lot of mystics and other progressive New Age thinkers that would kind of postulate just the opposite, and that more primitive, I hate to say that word, but kind of less culturally indoctrinated people are more sensitive to these kind of communications, and they're you know, part and parcel of their culture. So we can go down to, we can go drink ayahuasca with people in the Amazon basin, and they're constantly in contact with this spirit world. It's woven into their society in a way that we can't even understand. So how do we square those two?
It makes sense for us to do it via technology, no? That's the route we're taking in the modern West. We are certainly a materialist culture, but we have a lot of science that tells you that if we took all the space out of the atoms in your body, you would be reduced to an amount of matter that is a very small microscopic dot. So we know that, and there's even noise now in scientific communities that space as well as time may just be perceptual tricks. They may not exist. So we are getting there, but we're doing it in our own clumsy way, and it's going to have the scientific support because that's the culture that we live in. Still, it's happening. I'm having a 100% success rate getting people to do their own mediumship with those departed they love. Now, that would not have happened even 20 years ago. So, and it's amazing how people are just popping out. You just give them a permission to do psychic work or after-death communication or whatever it is, and they just go to it.
You know, it's also interesting what you bring up, Julia, about the idea of this relationship we have with time not being maybe what it appears to be. And, of course,
right,
as you just referenced, science has been telling us that for the last 100 years. I mean, that's what Einstein told us, and everyone loves Einstein, but everyone just kind of glosses that over because it doesn't fit with our perception of reality. Now, I also think it's interesting that we have some modern day research that points in that direction. I always like to cite Daryl Bem, who was Dr. Daryl Bem, former guest on this show, who did this interesting research that kind of blew up on the modern media and pointed out that he had students who were studying for a vocabulary test after they took the test and showed improvement by doing that. So it's kind of turns this whole idea of time on its head, which
absolutely,
maybe there's some reality to that. Now, you do that as well in your book in talking about simultaneous incarnations. Perhaps perhaps you want to tie that together and first tell people what you mean by that and how you've come to understand that as being some kind of reality.
Well, I've come to understanding it because I am an academic. I look at material as presented either as published or in my own professional experience and try to make sense out of it in a somewhat of an objective way. What is this material telling me? And what you see time and time again is that if you're working with after-death communication, is that people, when they die, have an afterlife. No part of their personality dies, nor do they leave the afterlife to come back into another incarnation. This is a hard thing for people to accept because we put incarnation in this spiritual evolution model and as a cause and effect and a time-bound phenomenon. That's not really what happens. What happens is you have people who are alive and people who are dead coexist. So your incarnations coexist. All of your incarnations coexist with you now. And in fact, in alive and in death states, if you eliminate time, you can see this. And in fact, you can have incarnations who are embodied now, who are contemporary to you. And just in the same way that you can have several incarnations in one body. It's consciousness is extremely elastic.
How have you experienced this as a medium? How have you encountered this with people you've worked with?
Yes. Not only that, I mean, I know one extraordinarily strong incarnation of me who exists now, for instance. She came to me for past life readings, and I was unable to do them because every single past life I uncovered in the reading was my own. We also have the same future memory of a future incarnation whose name is Bernard. Very specifically, we met him 20 years apart.
Wow.
So I fully accept that she is and I am, we are incarnations of each other, that we split up in more than one body. That's not a problem. I've also had after-death communication with a person who is in an afterlife from the Victorian era and in the afterlife from the present era, who came through in different after-death communications and was entirely different in the way he communicated. But it was the same person. In other words, from the same soul group or the same oversoul or however you want to call command headquarters in terms of how incarnations work. The other is that, for me, following people into the afterlife, sometimes they present me with their other incarnations that they've met up with. It's a matter of inclusivity. It's what happens is that you incorporate more and more of your own immediate experience through your incarnations, and then it gets even broader. You just keep incorporating experience and knowledge in what people call learning, a word I don't like when it's applied to the afterlife. But it's a process of expansion, of expanding your awareness, and it's also a creative process. So that what happens in the afterlife is it's not that you meet all of your incarnations necessarily, but you can meet whichever ones you want. Now, also, I've worked as a past life therapist now since I think it was 1985 when I was certified, and you see a lot of strange stuff going on there too. It's just very, very possible to call in a future life, for instance, who is alive as we sit. So all of these things are happening in simultaneous time in non-local reality, the meaning of that being there's no place and there's no time. So in these non-local realities, it's like a radio that receives or can receive, is capable of receiving broadcasts from everywhere, but you only tune into one at a time. And yet we are capable of sidestepping that just in these adjacent realities and seeing contemporary, future, and past life personalities in the after-death state as well as in the physical to make contact with them. All of this is possible.
Possible. Great. I'm open. I want to hear it all. But I'm still left, you know, grasping with what do I do with this? I mean, you paint a picture of all of this being explainable, accessible, digestible. Here it is. Here's how it works. But will we ever really know that? Do we ever experience that on a personal level? Are we meant to experience that? Are we meant to know? Or is our human condition somewhat meant to be keeping us in doubt, in mystery, in wonder? Are we supposed to?
Who would mean you to do that? When we say we are we meant? Who's determining what we're meant to do and what not?
That's a good question. You talk a little bit. You talk in the book about God. You talk about God from a cultural perspective of what other people have thought about God, and you also talk about it from a personal perspective in your idea of a very, very big, big tent, big, big cloud God. Talk about that for a minute. And I love in the book when you talk about, for example, a Viking living in the 9th century and their idea of the afterlife and their idea of the moral imperative, if you will, what God wants him to do versus what we think God wants us to do.
Well, I don't imagine God wanting us to do anything. We are contained within this universal divinity, created by it and co-creating within it, and there are no real directives. We are not being directed by anyone. There's a certain overall mass consciousness of humans in the body. And these mass consciousness, of course, they change from culture to culture and from time and place. But and therefore, you have different constructions of an afterlife. And when a person dies, they bring their cultural bank with them. So they reconstruct a Valhalla, for instance, if that's what they deeply believe in. And that's what fulfills them. And then probably get past that soon enough. But my reason for bringing up these Vikings was our model right now of the afterlife is a learning ground in which you attend classes and are told when you can reincarnate or move up the evolutionary ladder.
Group therapy, I think, is the phrase.
Yeah, the group therapy model is just a disaster. And more people in New Age communities are investing in that. And this is, to me, antithetical to the whole spirit of the freedom and the impossible levels of creativity that go on when we're out of body. Now, getting back to this idea of limitations, yes, we have consented or wanted, chosen to have experiences that have a lot of limitations, but also have some great pleasures. The pleasure of, think of a toddler lying on the floor with his tongue wrapped around a table leg. You know, that kind of exploration with his tongue or her tongue, how deeply satisfying that is and how meaningful that can be to an infant. That's what this physical reality is about. We should be a little bit more playful and not worry so much about whether or not we're spiritual or we are. We're inherently that. That can't go away. And relax a little bit. The focus on material life is way over the top. What I call ego function, where we only operate within our physical senses, painted by our physical senses, that is over the top and does need to be loosened up. But we've got literally all the time in the world to accomplish all of this.
I have to say, I think one of the reasons why people do maybe move towards this learning model that you don't like, and I don't particularly like either, or the growing model, the group therapy model, and in particular, the moral, the God having a moral imperative, having a direction for us to go, is that we do get that information back pretty regularly and consistently from, for example, the near-death experience science research that we have. And by our normal measures of science, it looks pretty solid. I mean, it's cross-culturally consistent, and there is this loving being, or if it's not a being, this loving sense of connectedness. There is this sense of life review. There is this sense of good and bad. You know, you did good here. You didn't do good there. You didn't expand love. I mean, are you saying that maybe that is also culture-bound? And why would you say that?
Well, I think the way that you described it is actually not that accurate. I'm sorry to say, first of all, the life review does not always happen, and it happens more culturally. When people die, when they're permanently dead, there's rarely a life review. They have eons to do that. So, yes, there's a kind of a manifestation of the divine, a kind of a luminous fluid that we can actually access while we're in the body. You don't have to wait till you're dead to feel immortality. That's true. But in terms of a god or the being of light being a god, I think only some people have come to that conclusion. I would never agree that the being of light is God, but a manifestation of perhaps your own superconsciousness. And the idea that there's a good and bad, no, I don't see that at all in the material of near-death studies. I see more of that. The whole of the law is self-realization. And once you get to that point of self-realization, where good and bad are moral systems or whatever, you make your own choices about how you're going to change.
You know, it's interesting you should bring that up. And I think this topic of good and bad, evil, demonic, all that stuff is something that is of great interest to me, because I think we have to process that as part of this whole discussion. And if you process it the way that you do, fine. If you process it another way, fine. Just bring your data points, bring your evidence, and let's hash it out. One of the guests we had on a while back is a woman named Nancy Evans Bush, who is a longtime near-death experience researcher, and she was on to talk about her book, Distressing Near-Death Experiences, and how she encountered, rather surprisingly, because she had kind of out of the blue, a very negative encounter with negative entities, negative spirit beings, whatever, during her near-death experience. And if you talk to near-death experience researchers, a lot of them will tell you, hey, this is out there. And a lot of paranormal researchers in general will say, this is out there, these negative spirits, negative entities that we can encounter. What do you make of that?
Well, these are not core personality negative entities. These are thought forms. And there is a difference between a near-death experience and permanent death. In permanent death, you can fall into hallucinations. You can have bad encounters. It depends on the mindset in which you died. So all of those things can exist, but they are things that are byproducts of the human mind. They are not inherently real in themselves. Near-death experiences, you might have noticed, have an enormous range of atmospheres and locales. These are things that are tailor-made by the person who's having the near-death experience, not otherwise. They're not going to a place in which there are demons or angels. They're going into a non-physical reality that is not yet in the afterlife. There are always these borders, and they can't cross them. And you can have all kinds of experiences in those places. I work with people who, after they've died, have had a lot of trouble, or were in denial about death or whatever, and they see some of this stuff happening, but you can clear it up in a matter of minutes with them. And so, you know, I've worked a long, long time in this field. I've done exorcisms. I have never seen any evidence for evil. I've only seen evidence for the belief in evil. I have done exorcisms on houses. I've worked with people who were picked up and slammed against walls, beds rising, all this kind of stuff. And at the absolute base of it all is really conflict, not evil. Human conflict, which is also what calls poltergeist.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because I have to say, before I ask you what you mean by that, this is a fascinating topic, because I've talked to so many people and I've heard what you've just said before several times from very highly respected out-of-body experience or paranormal experiencers, mystics, if you will. But I've also heard the opposite. You know, I had on a woman named Marilyn Hughes who actually joined me for an experiment, an on-air mediumistic experiment we did, where I was the proxy, and we found this woman in Austin, Texas, who had lost her daughter to suicide, a teenage daughter. And this reading was really quite amazing and was very, very healing to the mother. And I have to say, as being the proxy, the intermediary who was trying to not pass any information before, I think the reading was highly evidential. So something was going on there. But where it really gets interesting and where it contradicts what you're saying is Marilyn's understanding of what she does is travel into these other realms, the same kind of extended consciousness realms that you're talking about. But she has a very different idea of the dark evil forces, and that sometimes people wind up in places where they don't know how to get out of, and that she sees this more as an evolutionary learning kind of thing of getting out of that and going to the light. Now, tell us once more, you know, why do we want to look at it from your perspective, or how is this person getting, and so many other people like her, are getting this other perception from it? How do we, as someone who doesn't have a psychic experience, how do we figure out who's telling it like it is?
Well, you know, it is an interpretive thing. This idea of there being lower realms, this is all very, very old-fashioned stuff, and the invention of an overarching evil is something that's quite new. It's 5th century B.C. It was not known before then. It started developing in Iran and ancient Judaism. So there was never really this kind of opposite of good and evil going on until then. So you have to look at that from an historical point of view as an invention. In many ways, the universal creativity thing is a little bit neutral with a tendency towards the benign. That's a statement I can't support with data. But what I can say is that from my own experience, were I to be experiencing what this woman experienced, my interpretation would be entirely different. I would understand it more as a psychological process the person needs to go through. I have really done a lot of rescue work in these situations of a person who has hallucinated a hell and can't get out of it. It's a purely hallucination based on his own ideas about an afterlife and his own ideas of what he deserves. And he had to be sprung. And his dead son came to me and asked me to help him with it. His son didn't want to have any contact, and I did. It was really a rather simple matter. But I have worked with suicides who die, for instance, from drug overdoses, so-called accidental suicides. And they can also be in a lot of hallucinatory situations, many of which are not so pleasant. But these are... The afterlife is not about realms, it's about consciousness. It's not about places where, you know, you hear all this stuff about earthbound spirits and, you know, riding on people and forcing them to commit murder and all this kind of stuff. And then these same authorities who write so strongly about all this, who are so convinced that there's this whole underground world of demented souls, are people who are also supporting how much better life is than death is, because all these souls want to come back. The second thing that it just amuses me to no end, actually it angers me really, is that these same people, all they have to do is to get the attention of that soul and tell them that they're really dead, and then all of their murderous tendencies and their hold on humanity and other human souls, where they suck the human soul into these horrible realms, disappears just on the words of these authorities. Now, come on. These things are thought forms. They're generated by our own consciousness, whether we're alive or dead. And they can be quite powerful. But that doesn't mean that they're anything core, that there's a core evil. That I could never agree to, and it's certainly within my almost 4 decades of experience, cannot say I have ever encountered. And I've encountered things that are standard, that look demonic, and actually, when I worked with them, they were kind of cute. But they were scaring the hell out of the people they were living with.
Dr. Asante, you have a fascinatingly refreshing perspective on talking to the dead. And you start out by pointing out that almost every study or survey we've looked at suggests that almost everybody does it. Grieving spouses do it. Grieving parents certainly do it. Even most of us who are not grieving do it. And as you point out in the book, I loved even skeptics and atheists do it. Yeah. What's going on here? How can we kind of bring that out into our general awareness that, hey, this is something we're already doing, and then let's talk about how we can do it better?
Well, that's the first thing. You hit the nail on the head. To recognize that we're doing it. That's really the first thing, because most of us think it's just fantasy or imagination. wishful thinking. But truthfully, wishful thinking will not clear up post-traumatic stress disorder, but real communication with the dead can, and it can do it in one session. Even post-traumatic stress disorder that goes on for a full generation after, say, wartime. So with intrusive memories, suicide, longing, and nighttime sweats and the whole business can get cleared up with one session with a pertinent deceased. So we can't say that this is fantasy or wishful thinking. It's certainly very instrumental at the deathbed scene. And one area where we're making a lot of progress is the acceptance of hospice nurses or hospice personnel that the deceased do come for the dying. And more hospice personnel and paramedics are beginning to experience these deceased too, to see them. They also are beginning to recognize the person who has just died, who comes back to thank them, or they can still feel their energy. And more having shared death experiences, including doctors, in which they actually watch the energy body leave the physical body upon death. So we are getting there. And once it hits the medical field, as it's doing now, it'll trickle through into the popular sector, which is already through the news and entertainment industry, already going in that direction at full speed, partly trained through the internet. You know, and a chat room and after-death communication are so analogous. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to recognize how much we're doing it, and the second thing is to, when you suspect it's happening, to maximize it. And that really is about giving your full attention to whatever presence you're experiencing. That could be something that's just a mental intrusion or a storm going on in your head that has something to do with someone you know who's died. The lyrics may be telling you something, or the song is strongly associated with the deceased. One of the main ways that people experience a real presence is with this kind of body tingling, similar to the feeling of inspiration, where sort of a delicious chill goes down your back. And I think inspiration is probably, there is a deceased there very often giving it to you. So learning to recognize the signs, grief waves can be another sign, a surge of grief can be a very strong sign. I elaborate on all this in the book. So it's not a problem if anybody wants to know about the signs for spontaneous encounters and how to set up communication on your own. I have chapters on that in the book.
In the book, you actually have some how-to material in terms of how to connect more effectively with the dead.
How it looks and the various forms that communication has come in. A lot of the signs that people have, you know, such as the problems with the lights blowing out or the phone ringing and there's no one there, have to do with the deceased trying to get through to us, and they can't. Once you make contact, all of that phenomena will stop.
Why can't they?
Because culturally, we don't believe in it, or we refuse it. You know, necromancy was punishable by pain of death on stoning, by stoning. We've inherited this. I mean, it was outlawed by the churches, and there still has a sinister, dark quality to it that which has been maximized by the entertainment industry as a dangerous thing. You hear this all the time about how dangerous it is. If you look at the actual records, it's never dangerous. The thousands, hundreds and thousands of published records, there are people who work with it as a induced after-death communication therapist or whatever it is. There's no record of real harm ever being done. It's always well-intentioned, but we have these ideas that it is. Even talking to the dead, even that sounds horrible, like you're going to be pulled over into that dark realm.
Mm-hmm.
So we have very bad cultural attitudes, and again, these attitudes are in conflict with the actual experience of meeting Uncle Harry, bathed in light, and the sense of your body changes when this happens, when you have full after-death communication with something that transfigures in the electromagnetic field.
So what should we do then? I mean, to what lengths should we go to make these connections? What about psychedelics? What about shamanic rituals? I mean, are there any...
necessary. None of that's necessary.
Necessary,
it's so much simpler than all of that. You don't have to rig anything up, really. All you need is genuine desire.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing. It's not about curiosities. You know, it's real desire to know how someone is, or to correct a wrong, or reconciliation, or whatever. And if you approach communication with someone you love who's departed from your truest emotion, it's...
What about the use of mediums, psychics, intermediaries?
Well, that's, of course, you know, wonderful. And I do a lot of that, as you know. But my job is when the deceased appear, usually the person who's come to see me, not usually, always, the person who comes to see me immediately feels it. Usually it's from tears and the sense of this tingling. And my job is to get them to have direct communication, because it's more effective and it's something you can do without a medium, a professional medium. The studies show that working with a professional medium can be exhilarating initially, but can also bring a person back into a sense of devastation and helplessness and grief. And grief and helplessness in this case are almost... equated with each other here. A lot of grief is about helplessness. So my thing is to get each person to recognize that they already have these skills. We're all telepathic. You can't have that more clinically proved than it is. It's just been proved over and over again in clinical trials with non-professional, everyday, average guy off the street having telepathic abilities. We couldn't even have a culture without telepathy. So... Understanding all the skills you need are inborn, proceed from your strongest emotion and make contact. There's things you can do that can enhance the experience, such like creating sacred space, and I give all of those things in detail in the book. It's quite easy. That's the crazy part. And also to recognize how often you're already doing it.
Right.
A prayer is a form of after-death communication very often when you pray to someone in the beyond.
Well, it's certainly a well-constructed argument. Fascinating, fascinating book for anyone interested in this topic. It's an absolute must-read. Again, the title is The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. That's really what the book is about. Dr. Asante, it's been a great pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for joining me.
It was a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Asante for joining me today on Skeptico. I have a couple of questions to tee up for this interview. I have to tell you, this is an interview that's really stuck with me for quite a while. Dr. Asante is, as you can tell, extremely intelligent, well-spoken, and very confident about what she's learned about communicating with departed spirits, if you will. So here are a couple of questions I'd throw out. One, and this is a big one, when we move into this realm of the non-material and we start talking about extended consciousness, spirit communication, and all the rest, how do we figure out who we should listen to? How do we figure out who are the real experts? Dr. Asante has done medium readings with hundreds, probably thousands of people. Does that make her an expert on the afterlife? Dr. Eben Alexander, who we often reference on this show, died and went to heaven. Does that make him an expert? You could fill in any number of guests we've had on this show, list their qualifications and experience, and ask the same question. Who do you trust, and why do you trust them? So that's question number one. For question number two, I'd push that a little bit further and ask you to speculate on what you make of medium communication as it fits into this body of knowledge we're attempting to amass here. So we have a lot of different ways we can quote-unquote know about the afterlife, about extended consciousness. We can have channeled material, out-of-body experience material, near-death experience, remote viewing, all sorts of different means of knowing. How should we look at mediumistic experiences like the kind that Dr. Asante has relied on? What are the pros? What are the cons? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to weigh in on these questions and share your opinions with me and other listeners is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can leave a comment right there on the website or click on over to the forum and drop a note there. Of course, you can also send me a note on Facebook or drop me an email. Try and get to as many of those as I can. So that's about it for this time on Skeptico. I have a number of interesting shows coming up and a number of interesting interviews scheduled. So there's plenty more to come, and I do hope you'll stay with me for all of it. Until next time, take care and bye for now.